and non-oppressive relationships, reads the group's mission statement. You can learn more by going to socialist.nyc, or you can reach the Catholic Worker Mary House by calling 212-777-9617. Then on Saturday, May 5th at 11 a.m., the annual NYC Cannabis Parade will be held in Union Square in Manhattan. The parade is the longest-running public demonstration for the reform of drug policy in New York City and around the world, according to a statement from organizers. Join us on May 5th as we march and rally to end cannabis prohibition, stop racially motivated arrests, and expand and improve the state's medical marijuana program. You can learn more about the demonstration by going to cannabisparade.org or by calling 347-903-4367. And on Wednesday, May 16th at 7 p.m., Verso Books and the magazine Jacobin will hold a conversation between Dr. Cornel West and Professors Adolph Reed Jr. and Heather Gottney entitled Crashing the Party from the Bernie Sanders Campaign to a Progressive Movement at BMCC's Tribeca Performing Arts Center at 199 Chambers Street in Manhattan. Bernie Sanders shocked the political establishment by winning 13 million votes and a majority of young voters in the 2016 Democratic primary, reads a statement from organizers. Since that upset, repeated polls have judged this Democratic socialist to be the most popular politician in the United States. What lessons can be drawn from his surprising insurgent campaign? Find out more by sending an email to verso@versobooks.com, or you can reach the Tribeca Performing Arts Center by calling 212-220-1459. That's the WBAI Resistance Calendar for the week ending Saturday, April 28th. I'm Jesse Lent.
It's just like we've decided there'd be some words we won't say all the time. And I was just trying to find out which words they were. I wanted a list, because nobody gives you a list. And all I could think of was That was my original list. I knew it wasn't complete, but it was a starter set, you know?
George Carlin in the 1970s. Now those seven words and more can be heard at WBAI's monthly benefit comedy show, Too Raw for Radio. It's Monday night, May 7th, at 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons at 388 Atlantic Avenue. A $13 admission includes a $3 credit for food and drink at the cafe. That's Too Raw for Radio Comedy Show, Monday, May 7th, 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons. And you can find us on Facebook at Too Raw for Radio.
And here's the list of words your dad and I don't ever want to hear you say. Hey, thanks, Ma. Boy, that's going to save me an ass-kicking or two. Ah! Oh.
This is Bob Lederer. Welcome to Health Action. On today's program, we'll be exploring the crisis of black maternal mortality, which in New York City is currently 12 times the rate experienced by white mothers, and which afflicts black women of all income levels. You will hear a recent presentation by Dr. Camille Clare, Associate Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at New York Medical College, on the underlying factors that go far beyond black women's health risks, exposing the role of structural racism in society and in the healthcare system. This includes substandard hospital care and unconscious bias by medical providers, as well as the damage to black women's physiology done by constant exposure to the stress of living in a racist society. Following Dr. Claire's presentation, there was a lively discussion with the audience, which included many midwives and doulas who talked about alternative models of childbirth support. This discussion occurred at the monthly educational forum of the New York Metro chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program, an advocacy group for universal single-payer health care, held on March 13, 2018. For full disclosure, I should say that I am executive director of the New York Metro chapter. Fortunately, this issue has recently received some much-needed media attention with the publication of reporter Linda Villarosa's in-depth feature in the New York Times Magazine on April 11, 2018, titled Why America's Black Mothers and Babies Are in a Life-or-Death Crisis. For an interview with Linda on Democracy Now! And a link to her article, visit www.democracynow.org. And now, here is the recent forum on black maternal mortality, introduced by Martha Livingston, Ph.D., professor and chair of public health at SUNY Old Westbury, and vice chair of Physicians for a National Health Program, New York Metro Chapter.
So as I was thinking about how to really introduce this forum, not just Dr. Claire, I thought about January 21st, 2017, an extraordinary women's march, and the sign that I and a lot of people who look around my age were carrying that day that said, I can't believe I'm still protesting this shit. I thought about how I got involved, not just in this organization, but in caring about healthcare justice. I started out my political work in about fifth grade in civil rights support work. And I then moved into, as well, work on women's rights. And as the women's movement did, I moved into issues around women's health rights, especially the right to abortion. And then as I aged and my life progressed, I moved into the issue of reproductive health concerning actually not just not having a child when I didn't want one, but having one when I was ready to have one. That's when I started to get interested in midwifery and really much more deeply into overall women's health issues. And I went on then to do my dissertation on childbirth. I almost became a midwife, but at that time in the state of New York, with a master's degree, I would have had to become an RN, be a floor nurse in labor and delivery for 2 years, and only then be allowed to study midwifery. So I said, what the hey, if I'm going to spend all those years in training, they're going to call me doctor when I'm done. So that's why I went in the direction that I went. I want to contextualize this talk, which is a very particular kind of talk. That is to say, you know, we talk about women are some of the people of color. People of color are some of women. You can't do that. You have to really look at this in a much more holistic kind of way. This topic is really a trifecta because it hits on sexism in medical care, it hits on racism in medical care, and it hits on, frankly, with all due respect to the OBGYNs in the room, the real misunderstanding that lots of OBs, I'm sure nobody in this room, have about the normal physiological process that is childbirth, and the consequent, the resulting sequelae, the resulting complications of birth that result from simply not letting that process take its, just be carried out. Having studied this, having become a childbirth educator, the other issue though too is to contextualize birth and reproductive health within the overall under-doctoring that women get on our non-female parts, as well as the over-doctoring that happens to our female parts. And frankly, I can't believe I'm still protesting this shit. There's a new book that came out last week called Doing Harm that is about the same stuff that I started reading about 35 years ago, about really the quite mediocre and often terrible care that women get at the hands of doctors, not necessarily because they're bad people, but because they just flat don't understand women's bodies. It's time that we moved right along on that. We've had lots of progress in lots of other aspects. That is to say, a lot more women are in med school than were when I started to study this stuff 35 years ago. This issue that we're going to talk about tonight, however, as I say, it's a trifecta. It hits on all of the issues that make it hard for women, and especially women of color, and especially African American women, to get the care that we need in birth. And consequently, we have the kinds of results that we're talking about here. The U.S. is the only wealthy industrialized country in the world that doesn't have health care as a right to all of our people, and that underlies some of the issue, not all of it for sure, but some of it, and that's what this group is all about. So we see these issues as very much aligned with the health justice work that we are trying to do. Dr. Camille Clare is Associate Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology and Associate Dean of Diversity and Inclusion at New York Medical College. She's also an attending physician at Metropolitan Hospital, part of New York City H&H. And she is president of the Manhattan Central Medical Society, the local affiliate of the National Medical Association. For those who may not know, that is the professional organization for African American physicians. And she is an active member of ACOG, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Dr. Clare, thank you so much.
So, thank you so much for the invitation. I'd like to thank Bob Lederer from PNHP, as well as Ali Fine, who we sit together on the physicians, New York Physician Coalition, and so it's really nice to see so many friends, to hear about a topic that can be quite sombering, but hopefully we'll be able to talk about some of the strategies that's going on in New York to address some of these issues. I'd also like to thank Dr. Runa Ray, who extended the invitation to me. Kind of what we're going to do today is talk a little bit about not only mortality, but severe maternal morbidity, which is also a very serious issue. We're going to talk about and review some statistics. We're going to also talk about racism and implicit bias and some implications for maternal health in particular, as well as some policy improvements looking at maternal health equity and specific strategies, including the Safe Motherhood Initiative, which was conducted by ACOG, and some maternal mortality reviews that are going on in New York State. So just some definitions. So severe maternal morbidity are unintended outcomes from the process of labor and delivery that can have long-term and short-term consequences for maternal health. So we speak a lot about mortality, but morbidity is also extremely, extremely important, as well as common. So, you know, so the deaths are kind of like the tip of the iceberg. And as I mentioned, SMM is more common than even deaths, 50 to 100 times more common. Is also associated with increased death. So just in terms of some racial and ethnic statistics in New York State, 15% of the live births in New York State are born to Black non-Hispanic mothers, and 27% of those women who have maternal morbidity during delivery are also Black and non-Hispanic, compared to 23% of those live births that are born to Hispanic mothers, and about 30% of those with morbidity are Hispanic. So we're not going to exclude any particular other racial and ethnic groups, but most of this talk is going to be talking about Black women. We haven't forgotten about those other groups that are subjected to some issues as well, but I just want to emphasize that that's what we're mostly going to be talking about in this talk. So again, some of these stats are dated back to 2012, and we know that about almost 20%, again, of live births are born to Black women, and 42% of those pregnancy-related deaths were Black mothers. So pregnancy-related just means those deaths that happen within a year of delivery, not necessarily associated or caused by, but maybe associated, including terminations of pregnancy as well. So according to the New York State Maternal Mortality Reviews, it kind of identifies some of those 62 pregnancy-related as well as 104 pregnancy-associated but not related deaths in 2012. And the most common causes included embolism, which is blood clots, severe hemorrhage or bleeding, infection, as well as heart conditions. One of them is just called cardiomyopathy. And the leading causes of pregnancy-associated deaths include injury, cancer, infection, and also heart conditions. So in terms of some trends, if we look again at maternal mortality, which is again deaths within 42 days at the end of pregnancy, Black women, and this is per 100,000 live births, Black women is up here at about 55 compared to white women, which is a 15, and this is all other groups, which is about 10. And so again, New York State data from the Department of Health, really, as we talked about already, Black women are 3 times more likely to die during pregnancy or childbirth, twice as likely to die compared to white women from a maternal morbidity, not actually death. And so some of the important factors that have been contributed to that also increased risk of morbidity include how people's health were prior to getting pregnant, the prevalence of obesity and other diseases before pregnancy, people's access to care, and that. So those are some issues that my PNMP colleagues can speak to even more so than I can. Housing inequities, segregation in New York State, poor education, as well as racism. And one of my colleagues, Dr. Kamara Jones, which I'll refer to, says that part of our issue is that if we don't even name, we can either deny racism or be afraid to name it. So hopefully this is a safe space, and I think it is, for us to name racism as a cause. So we'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. So we kind of alluded to a lot of these statistics, and I don't want to bore you too much with statistics, but kind of get to the meat of really why you came to hear to hear me. So we're going to kind of defer a little bit to some of the implications of racism and implicit bias on maternal health. So birth equity was a term that was coined by, again, Dr. Joya Creer-Perry, kind of looking at that intersection of reproductive justice that Dr. Livingston mentioned and the process of birth. So it really is defined as the assurance of conditions of optimal births for all people, regardless of their racial or social inequalities, and our willingness to address that. If we look at some of the root causes, we know that institutional racism as well as oppression in terms of class and gender discrimination can affect all that power and wealth imbalance that we see here in terms of housing inequities, people's economic issues, globalization in the worldwide markets, and that can ultimately affect people's social determinants of health that are very familiar to us. That's like a common sexy term that people are using all the time now, but really that refers to some food inequities or job security issues, again, housing inequities, problems with living wage, and all those factors can cause someone to have some psychosocial stresses as well as unhealthy behaviors, and that can ultimately lead to some disparities in terms of disease and health. So if we look at race as a social construct, not a biological one, we know that basically how we categorize ourselves socially can really play a factor into our health and can compromise health. So it's not the race, a biological issue of race, that can compromise health, but the fact that people are subjected to racial biases and systemic biases that can lead to poor outcomes in health. So if we look at some examples, Black immigrant women who come from Africa or Caribbean actually and come to the U.S. actually have better health outcomes or birth outcomes than women that are born in the United States of America. So that's something to think of, to keep in mind. As well as Black mothers who have a college education are also do better than white women who never even finished high school. So again, if we look at things through the lens of racial equity, we know that very often inequities are really determined by race and ethnicity, income, language, but the healthcare system alone can't really address that because it's an institutional racist system. So if we talk about the levels of racism, there's again institutional racism, internalized racism, and that which is personally mediated. And this really comes from a lot of the work of Dr. Kamara Jones, who was really able to define this and name this a little bit better. So institutionalized racism, again, structures, policies, practices, norms that really disproportionately affect people's ability to access goods and services and opportunities because of their race, as opposed to personally mediated racism where people have different assumptions about their abilities and intentions because of their race. So people believe that they're already supposed to have poor health outcomes because of who they are, or the health system is supposed to treat them differently because of who they are, and that's really actually not true. And internalized racism, again, accepting these entitlement and these negative messages by both stigmatized and non-stigmatized groups. So again, not to belabor this point, but again, racial inequities are actually deliberate, and they can also be undone by deliberate political actions and advocacy. And so that's what we're really talking about in this room. So if we look at the timeline of the African American experience, we know that dated back to the 1600s, when black people were brought here against their will, we know that for about 85% of those who experienced the black experience, that has been a one of racial oppression. And 100% of that has been a struggle for humanity and equality throughout all of the last 400 years. So that's something to bear in mind. If we talk about the process in New York State of redlining, it's not that people just came and lived where they wanted to just because they wanted to live there in areas that had poor access to a lot of the privileges that we may be familiar with, but it's because of deliberate policies and practices in New York State and outside of New York State. So many people are familiar with redlining. Basically, that's the process of arbitrarily assigning folks to specific neighborhoods because they were poor or they were people of color. So that's basically what it really was, to deny people the ability to access homes or purchase homes because they were just relegated to certain specific neighborhoods. And again, if we look at that throughout all of New York State, we can see that often that was done throughout many of the boroughs. So if we look at implicit bias, in contrast to that, it's really just sort of the implicit aspects of prejudice, maybe not out and out racism, but some unconscious notions that all of us have. Every single one of us in this room have these stereotypes and judgments that are based on gender or ethnicity or weight or things like that. So that's something to think about, that both racism and implicit bias can affect our health care and our health care decision making. So again, implicit bias is really inherent. It's really determined by what we see on the media, by what we hear, by how we grew up, and all those things can really affect, again, our ability to offer appropriate health care to others. So if we take a diversion a bit and really talk about the New York City hospital system and the healthcare system, that's something that we should really think about. So in New York, the insurance status was eliminated and replaced by economic segregation. So as of 1994, hospitals were really segregated based on someone's income as opposed to their insurance status. So as a result of that, poor and people of color in New York State are less likely to be treated in the quote-unquote best hospitals. And so they're black serving hospitals compared to white serving hospitals. And I'm in a safety net hospital myself in Metropolitan, so I can speak to that. And very often, it's not that their care is worse, it's that they're under-resourced. They don't get the appropriate reimbursements at those particular places. So it's not the people or the physicians or the nurses or any other healthcare providers that are offering poor care. They're under-resourced. So that's something that's really important to keep in mind. So as of 2014, Medicaid was the primary provider for about 60% of all the births in New York City. However, patients have a lot of barriers because there are caps on the number of visits they can have. Private payers, usually at a particular hospital, may not accept Medicaid. And again, these hospitals are most likely to reach out to those with private or commercial insurance as opposed to patients that have Medicaid or are self-pay. So again, if we look specifically at racism and maternal health, again, 3 out of 4 black women deliver at about 1/4 of all the hospitals throughout the country. We already said that this maternal morbidity is 3 times more likely in black women compared to white women. And in addition to that, this morbidity is very common in those with Medicaid or any other types of insurances compared to those who have private or commercial-based insurance. Brookdale Hospital in Brooklyn is one such example where patients who have low income, they're non-gentrified areas of Brooklyn, they have 4 times the likelihood to have complications from childbirth compared to any other area hospital in that particular area. So half of those mothers actually really have complications that are specifically related to hemorrhage compared to any other hospital, and also more likely to need a blood transfusion. So if we look at the map of New York City based on severe morbidity, this is really something to bear in mind. And you can see certain areas of New York City, the morbidity based on 10,000 deliveries are much higher based on community districts. So that's something also to bear in mind. And this data is a little bit old, from 2008 to 2012. So what are some of the determinants of this mortality? In addition to morbidity, we kind of referred to this earlier in terms of the social determinants of health, but housing instability, concentrated areas of poverty, safety of particular neighborhoods, poor access to good quality health care, limited educational opportunities leading to poor employment opportunities, and all that can affect some clinical manifestations of disease. So again, if we look at, again, the most common causes of morbidity and mortality and specific rates of the statistics, but again, VTE or blood clots, 15% of those lead to that out of 10,000 births. 5% of those are causes for ICU admissions. 2% lead to severe morbidity. In terms of infection, again, 10% as a cause for mortality. 5% of those are lead to ICU admissions, as well as 5% as a cause for severe morbidity. And bleeding in particular, about 15% of those lead to mortality. A third lead to ICU admissions, and about 50% lead to severe morbidity, and so forth. So I don't want to belabor the point that was sort of mentioned in the video, and I don't want to focus too much on that, but I've already been accused of, as an OBGYN, of not listening to women, so didn't know how to take that, but I'll move on. So, but we really have to really consider and think about maternal experiences and their really what they're looking for in their childbirth experience. So, you know, I'm not going to focus too much on this, because if we look at these two, you know, famous and or infamous folks in the news, we know that regardless of your income, people are not necessarily hearing you and not really appreciating your experiences of childbirth and what you're looking for. So what's important is really offering respectful care and accountability to the healthcare system, of which many of us trained in. So the workforce, really the healthcare workforce currently, is really not able to recognize as well as address racial biases of its healthcare workforce. And that's something to really consider. So one example is that really often mothers report that they're really underestimate pain of childbirth and labor, specifically in undertreat African American patients. So that's something to think about and really be mindful in terms of maternal experiences and labor. So let's turn it around, not just talk about the doom and gloom, but what is being done in terms of a policy perspective to address some of these inequities that we spoke about. So again, hospital system leaders really have a responsibility to address and really improve preventable maternal deaths and the overall quality of health care. The health department has recommended some specific things, improving women's overall health, so that's called preconception health, how women do prior to even becoming pregnant, and really having them come into pregnancy at much earlier stages, the first trimester as opposed to later on in their pregnancies, really focusing on high-risk populations or those that have comorbidities that we mentioned before, really looking at harm reduction strategies to really address some of those issues that we talked about, you know, really being aware of the data that's out there in order to be able to address some of the things that we spoke about, really sharing the data with those of you and those who are concerned about health policy issues, and really looking at research in terms of these social determinants and how that affect women's outcomes. So these are other recommendations offered by the National Birth Equity Collaborative, and really one of the things, or some of the things that you spoke about, is standardization of the data from ACOG and health departments, looking at safety bundles, and we'll talk a little bit about how some standardized approaches to addressing some specific issues can address that, really being able to understand. racism, which, as I said, we can't be afraid to speak out on, regardless of who you are. Accepting all forms of insurance, including Medicaid, at all hospitals throughout the state as well as the country. Training health providers to really identify and address racial and reproductive justice, as well as we spoke about, focusing on research and the connections between maternal. And we're not talking about in this talk, but infant mortality and morbidity is also extremely high level, and that's really how the United States is judged compared to other countries, maternal morbidity and mortality, as well as infant morbidity and mortality. So some of these programs that they specifically focus on, worth mentioning the video, including the Black Mamas Matter movement and their advocacy efforts, and this was already referred to in the video. But what ACOG has done is, as of 2013, sort of developed the standardized approaches to specific conditions that have really been shown to increase moms' mortality, which is called the Safe Motherhood Initiative. They really do a specific drill down, looking at each case of maternal mortality throughout the state, go in, really analyze it from a systems point of view, not an individual point of view. It's a non-punitive approach, and you can go on the website to really learn more about it. It was a well-funded effort to really be able to address some specific issues, and we'll talk about one or two of those in a minute. There's also an app for that, so you can go online and you can put it right on your phone. So those who take care of women on a day-to-day basis, on a labor and delivery setting, just download it right on your app, right on your phone, and you'll be able to really have those standardized approaches to taking care of patients. New York State, through the Department of Health, has formed what's called these maternal mortality review committees, and again, that kind of extends the work of the SMI, where again, they're really doing a really good drill down, looking at every single aspect of the hospital, not just providers, not just nurses, not just people taking care of patients, but systems. What happens at the blood bank? Can people get the blood that they need? What happens in identifying some of the subtle cues and morbidities that can lead to death? So really doing that in-depth review. They also have a New York City Birth Equity Initiative, again, focusing on disparities that we mentioned, looking at three particular areas. Improving women's health before they get pregnant. We already talked about preconceptual care, as well as in between pregnancies. I can tell you honestly, as an OBGYN, I may not see the patient ever again until she comes up at my door, oops, and is pregnant. And then we have to deal with all of the issues that we may not have been able to address in between those pregnancies. Promoting safe sleep practices, again, for infants that I told you about already, as well as addressing some of those housing insecurity issues that I talked about. Really reducing the harmful effects of toxic stress, trauma. We know about gun violence that's heavy in the media, but we can't be afraid to address that and how that impacts the health of mothers and their families. I've already referred to this New York State Maternal Mortality Review Board, but again, the governor has supported these efforts and the Department of Health has supported these efforts. So hopefully they will continue to grow and foster. And actually throughout the country, we should be advocating for this in every single state. Some states are better than others at doing this. This really has led to some good algorithm approaches to addressing some of those common causes of death and morbidity. So we really have to advocate for that. New York State is really ahead of the curve on that. But outside of New York State, we really have to look at that and all throughout all the states. Many of you were at the New York Academy Summit, as I already mentioned. And so again, a white paper came out of that summit, and hopefully that'll be able to frame some of the issues that we've already talked about this evening. So I just want to mention again, one particular project that came out of the SMI looking at bleeding in particular as a top cause of maternal mortality. Again, the partners in this effort includes ACOG District 2 Office, the New York State Department of Health, the Hospital Association, as well as the Healthcare Association of New York State, really looking at some learning sessions, some coaching calls, looking at the data more specifically, really giving expert advice on some of the implementation of these bundles of care, so that again, standardized approaches to addressing some of these issues in sort of a checklist format that can be applied to multiple patients in these particular settings. Again, the goal is to really improve the readiness to respond to bleeding emergencies in a labor and delivery setting, developing rapid response teams, which is already happening, I know, in my particular hospital setting and many of the hospital settings throughout New York State, being able to better recognize bleeding and some of the risk factors that can lead to death of mothers, because we kind of miss some of those little subtle cues that can happen before women actually die, improving our response to bleeding and being able to better quantify and report what bleeding is using some standardized definitions and really being consistent and really being able to identify this from patient to patient. So I'm going to end on that note, and I apologize if I was going super fast, but I didn't want Bob to like give me the yank off of the presentation. So I think I'll open it up to questions, and I have a lot of my OB and midwifery colleagues, so if I feel like I can't answer the questions, I'll just direct them over to my colleagues in the room. So thank you very much.
And you've been listening to a presentation by Dr. Camille Clare, Associate Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at New York Medical College, speaking at a recent public forum by Physicians for a National Health Program here in New York City. And you're listening to Health Action on WBAI 99.5 FM New York. I'm Bob Lederer, and now on to part two, where we hear the audience questions and comments and Dr. Clare's responses.
Let me try to connect the first part of your talk with the second. First part sort of says that society makes life terrible for black women. Inherent bias and so on. The medical system can't change that, but we should be working on that. But that says to me that the way you treat black women who are pregnant be different than the way you would treat white women. You have to take more care about what stresses they're exhibiting, what behaviors they're exhibiting that might lead them to be more vulnerable during the birth process than a white woman. I mean, is that part of what you're talking about?
You probably should get up here. You summarized that extremely well. So, yeah, that's exactly the point of what I think we have to be aware of these particular vulnerabilities. But as I said, some of this is related to inherent racism that people are exposed to. So, again, we have to really be able to address that, name that, and not be afraid to do so. It has nothing to do with, you know, making people feel guilty for the history that we have, but we have to really be able to change that paradigm, and that's why we mentioned that.
Hi, I'm Denise Bowles. I'm the regional director for the Northeast for Dome International. I'm also a certified birth doula here in New York City. And I'm wondering if the inclusion of doulas into the care plan of black women could actually see a change. And the reason why I pose that question is because New York State has yet to identify and assign a CPT and ICD-9 code for doulas to be reimbursed the insurance companies. And I truly do think that if they do something like that, then maybe that could be a start of using community resources to better the outcomes for black women and birth.
Again, I think doulas, as well as any multiple types of childbirth care providers, address that childbirth experience and the maternal experience that women are looking for. So I can't speak to what you're advocating for in terms of CPT codes, but I think anyone in the process of labor that's addressing what moms are looking for are important. And they're, you know, part of the healthcare team and support for women in labor. And you know, we welcome them in terms of the process. And so, again, you know, I can't speak to, again, the CPT code part, but I can definitely say that that's part of the process that we support, just to ensure that everyone has an equitable birth experience, I think.
Hi, my name is Regina, and I'm also a doula. And it's, I actually posted it, I was coming here, and I was like, I hope I'm going to learn something new, right? Or is it going to be the same thing that I've been hearing over and over and over again? And unfortunately, that's what I feel like. It's not new. Okay. And so for me, I'd like to see more collaboration with midwives, with doulas, with childbirth educators, with OBs. There is Jenny Josephs, who's in Florida. She's a midwife, and she has something called the JJ Way. It's Common Sense Childbirth. It's evidence-based patient model of care, and she is improving maternal mortality in Florida just by simply listening to women, simply having all of her staff, when a woman walks in the door, they're listening. And so we spend the most money on maternal care, but yet our mothers are dying. Our black mothers are dying. So I'm just so I'm so mad, because it's like the same thing over and over and over again. When we have the answers, we've had the answers, but we choose not to listen.
Well, let me just say that I think that model of collaborative care is in many places in New York State hospitals and city hospitals. One of my head of midwifery is right here. I'm going to put her on the spot. And we have a collaborative practice and working together very well. We have doulas that come to our hospital as well. So, it's not really an us-them, and I don't want it to feel like it's an us-them. It's an all of us appropriately taking care of women. So I think my colleague, Dr. Russell, wants to speak to that, so I'll allow her to do so.
I really do. I'm an OBGYN in private practice, and so I'd say 90% of my patients are working with doulas that they pay more than they pay for their hospital stay, nor do they pay for their physician's care or their any of their care. So the cost of that, we have to figure out how most patients can access that. I didn't wear my t-shirt because I'm coming from my office, but I was going to wear my Listen to the Women sweatshirt. Oh. Because I do wear my Listen to the Women sweatshirt. The important thing in our listening is we have to, at some point, acknowledge, recognize, and move forward from the point that our systems are racist. And if we are working, I always say to myself, oh, did I join the wrong team? I'm an OB. Am I on the wrong team? I'm not on the wrong team. The system's wrong. I'm not wrong. But we have to acknowledge that if we're bringing patients into this system, we have to find a buffer for them. We have to make a soft place for them to land. And that soft place for them to land can be a provider who is a physician or a midwife or a doula, but we all have to acknowledge that just because I'm aware of the problem doesn't mean that I'm not a part of it, right? And one of the big things that we are learning in our new algorithm way of administering medicine is that we have lost our therapeutic interaction with patients, and we are having to learn how to re-listen to the women. Listening is not the end of it. It's not the whole part of it, but it is a very important part of it. But in bringing our patients, and particularly our black patients, into these systems, we have to bring them in not prepared to fight. And I have to argue that a lot of people come in prepared to fight, prepared to work in a system, and someone has to be prepared to be the buffer for that patient so that we can get the best outcome for that patient. This is something that the Coalition to Abolish Racism in New York City healthcare system, we have been working to try to acknowledge that this is a system that has to be broken and retooled, right? So in working with doulas and working with midwives and working with physicians, we all have to keep patient center and recognize this system is not created for this patient. We have to make the system accommodate the patient that we're caring for.
Hi, I'm Shira. I'm a midwife, and I work at Bellevue Hospital, so similar to a metropolitan, a public hospital. And I feel very lucky to get to do the work that I do with my patients and with my MD colleagues there. We have a really great relationship. One of the things that I've noticed, so I also have had the opportunity to teach a childbirth education class there, which is 2 3-hour sessions, and that has really opened my eyes to how many questions our patients have and how little time we actually have to answer those questions. So, you know, we're working in the clinic, we're seeing patients. Patients are waiting 3 hours to see us. We're so overbooked. They get 5 to 10 minutes with us. And we say to them, you know, we're trained as midwives. We care, you know, we're like a central tenet of our training. is listen to women and, you know, physiological work, then, like, really, like, what questions do you have? We want to answer those questions. But they can feel the energy that we have when we're like, hi, nice to see you. Do you have any questions for us? Like, that's a, you know, it's very hard if you come into an office with a provider to be able to ask your questions and to remember what your questions are if you can feel that they're actually not available to answer them. So when I started teaching this child birth education class and I started the class and I said, you know we have no time in clinic to answer your questions, here is space. And I just sat there. An hour and a half of the first 3-hour session are patients' questions. And they are basic, they are things that we would assume people would know about their bodies and about what giving birth is going to be like, because these are women who are in the, you know, in their third trimester. And it has opened my eyes to see how, even though I am a midwife and me and my midwifery colleagues and I are working so hard to infuse midwifery into the hospital experience, we aren't, it's what you were saying, we are under-resourced. We are not actually able to practice to the level of our scope of practice in that environment. And so, you know, centering pregnancy so that women wouldn't have to wait 3 hours to have a 5-minute appointment, instead could have a 2-hour class where they got to learn and be with one another. You know, there are ideas and excitement and passion that we have, but we are so underfunded and so underappreciated in the public health network. We're not able to actually maintain our full scope, our full practice 24/7 at this point, because they won't let us hire midwives as they move on. So anyway, just some hope and ideas.
I do know what you're saying. I mean, myself as an OBGYN, I also want to spend more time listening, and I felt a little stressed coming to the presentation because I'm like, oh, this is like my worst clinic day. I spent a lot of time with my patients today and felt like, oh, you know, I always want to give them much more than I'm able to give them because of the demands of all the other things and responsibilities that we have. But so I did all your comments and I appreciate what you're saying, for sure.
I wanted, I'm Steve, I'm not a doula or a midwife, pediatrician actually, but I wanted to, because we have a lot of folks in this room I think who may not have been to some of the other recent forums that we've had, and somebody brought up, I mean, we have a medical apartheid in New York City, which is actually worse than it is in many other cities that are not as nominally progressive. Because we have H&H, or HHC, H&H is still a bagel to me, so because we have HHC, it has allowed the private, voluntary, quote-unquote, hospitals to find ways to not take people of color, to not take persons who insurance as Medicaid, even though New York state law is more progressive. So by law, every hospital in New York state must take Medicaid, must take Medicare, and must offer a discount, a sliding fee scale discount, to the completely uninsured. That includes New York Hospital, that includes NYU, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, just to think of Manhattan examples I'm most familiar with. So there is this gross, and we've had multiple studies that show it's not just the residential segregation that is blocking. So you have NYU and Bellevue essentially in the same neighborhood along Bedpan Alley. Not, you know, one takes all the Medicaid, one finds ways to not take the Medicaid. Now I notice, I want to bring this back, because I noticed on one of your slides that you're working in coalition, as is appropriate, with the mainstream groups, including Greater New York Hospital Association, which is the association that represents the private voluntary hospitals, a law that is obviously being grossly violated day in and day out. And you're trying to form these coalitions with folks who, in all honesty, aren't the good guys. You know, they're taking a disproportionate amount of the disproportionate share money is going. So there's funding for hospitals that are disproportionate share, extra money that goes to them, and the formula is jiggered so that hospitals that don't actually do it get a big chunk of that money. So I just want to throw back to you, Camille, how you work with these folks and move them at the same time.
questions, please.
Yeah, I mean, I totally appreciate your comments. I think that that really has to do with, again, as we mentioned, being, you know, not only you're being of the system. So how can you be of the system and address some of these issues like segregated care? So, you know, again, you know, ACOG in general wants to be kinder and gentler in order to be able to move the needle in whatever way we can. So sometimes that does include getting into the bed with the enemy of sorts. So, you know, I agree with what you're saying, and I don't disagree with your comments at all, but I think we have to look at, you know, as many ways as we can to move the needle. And one of those is really looking at that data drilled down, and we have to get that information from the hospitals, and that's, otherwise we wouldn't even get that information to address those points, so. Yes.
Okay. I'm going to try and get through this coherently, but it's not going to be easy. So I lost a pregnancy in Bellevue because of a blip in my insurance coverage. And so I spent a whole lot of time waiting for appointments and trying to get medications in the pharmacy. And I don't know how you would have a healthy a positive experience in such an under-resourced environment. It must be incredibly difficult. But I went on to have deliver two children with midwives, and it was a wonderful experience, both different. But to your point, you talked about women not understanding their body, and yet my experience of the entire system, you know, the OBGYN, all of it, the medical system is actively disinforming us and telling us not to trust our bodies. Mm-hmm. I cannot believe the number of my peers who are scheduling C-sections because they don't think that they can deliver twins, when women have been delivering twins for, like, ever. So, and then to this person's, I got a little, had a reaction to this. There is bias that is existing in the care that women are receiving from day one when they walk into whatever provider. So the experience of racism, not only over your lifetime, if you're a black woman in this country, but then the racism that you're receiving directly through the care is exacerbating and perpetuating this. And so we can talk about policies and we can talk about the logistics of all of this, but what is happening in the education and the training of our medical professionals in the system to actually transform and let women trust their bodies and teach doctors, you know, that they have to interrogate their own racism and their own biases and uproot that. Sure. Because for me, that's like nothing's gonna, you can, whatever policies you want, nothing's gonna change if we don't address that.
Okay, I guess you're asking me to put my diversity hat on for the institutions that I work for, and I think academic medical centers and medical schools are really trying to address some of that those issues of racism and bias, you know, at the medical school level and the residency level, because we have to really, as I mentioned, really better inform our workforce. So I agree with you 100%, and I'm sorry that you had that experience in your own life. So I can hear the pain in your voice. So. Sorry for that.
It's not pain for me. You know, I learned a lot from that experience, and there's a lot of empathy that came out of that. And even that pregnancy that I lost was a beautiful, you know, it was a beautiful pregnancy and a beautiful life. But I share your fury.
Mm-hmm. That it's not only addressing racism, it's also addressing how are we educating our healthcare providers. Yeah. Like, that's bottom line to me.
Okay, I think we have time for one or two more questions and comments.
I'm a midwife, and I was trained as a doula, and I work as an educator now, in the maternal child health educator in the hospital. And I've been listening to all the different sides, but one of the things that was touched on, like in the slides and in the presentation in this video, was that it's not just black women who are poor who are dying. Mm-hmm. It is wealthy, very educated black women, yes, who have lower who have worse outcomes than poor white women. So that can only speak to just really inherent racism in the system. Mm-hmm. And so unless we do more, we practice equity rather than equality, unless we open our eyes and we really call it out, we're not going to change that. But another thing I wanted to say from just seeing, interacting with all kinds of women are dying. Like the woman who died, why was that's just to me that was just to pit a woman who had was just, what is called it, malpractices. Didn't you ask her what was her history? And the white lady who died in New Jersey, the nurse, the NICU nurse who trusted her colleague, that was just malpractice. So what is causing us to have so much malpractice? Partly education, because I see where, when we try to get residents, actually I was thinking about how a wonderful interdisciplinary rungs I used to have with you. And now I'm trying to get those interdisciplinary rungs to happen in my hospital. The residents won't want to talk to the nurses. The nurses are scared because they get bullied so badly. So it's just that, it is a lot of things. And we really have to change our education. We have to change the hierarchy in medicine. We have to, but a big thing that's missing, because I do the OB tours and I educate the women who come in, is that women don't know anything about OB, anything about breastfeeding, about their own, like she said, about their own bodies, about the capabilities of their own bodies. They trust us, they trust doctors, they trust the nurses, they trust professionals to take care of them, and oftentimes we are not living up to their trust. We lie to them, we rush into the back to our offices, so we pit them even when they shouldn't be pitted, because we want to hurry up and get this birth. And they're not only MDs who are obstetricians who are being abusive to women. Sometimes midwives can be abusive to women. And so we have to, like, just, as somebody said, take apart our system and put it back together, kind of.
Excuse me, before we go, I just want to invite everyone, if you don't know all the players in Black Maternal Health, I have in the past, since 2009, I have a very successful internet podcast called Birth While Black, and I have interviewed across the United States everyone from Shafia Monroe to Hakima Payne to Loretta Ross, who's one of the original founders of Sister Song. All of the major players in Black Maternal Health have been guests on my show. So if it's podcast, you just have to Google Denise Bowles, or you can go to Block Talk Radio, Birth While Black, and you can see the first.
Thank you so much, Dr. Claire. I think if we take away one message from this forum, it is, frankly, our message, PNHP's message, that without a national health insurance system, an improved Medicare for All system that guarantees that we all have a right to care, period, the end, regardless of who we are, we cannot really successfully demand a birth and midwifery and OB system that is really responsive to our women's needs, Black women and all women in this country.
And you are listening to a recent forum on the crisis of Black maternal mortality, sponsored by Physicians for a National Health Program, New York Metro Chapter, an advocacy group for universal single-payer health care. For background information on this issue, visit tinyurl.com/blackmaternalmortality. Again, that's tinyurl.com/blackmaternalmortality. For upcoming events by Physicians for a National Health Program, visit www.pnhpnymetro.org. Again, pnhpnymetro.org. And finally, for a recent interview with New York Times Magazine reporter Linda Villarosa on her in-depth feature titled Why America's Black Mothers and Babies Are in a Life or Death Crisis, visit www.democracynow.org. Finally, I want to remind our listeners that only with your financial support can we keep this non-commercial free speech radio station on the air. If you value programs like these, please become a sustaining member of WBAI, called a BAI Buddy. You can commit as little as $10 a month, which will be painlessly deducted from your credit or debit card, and become a member of the station, entitled to all sorts of special privileges. To sign up, go to give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. And if you'd like, you can click on Health Action as your favorite show. I want to thank Philip Swift and John Riley for technical assistance. for Health Action.
This is Comrade Karl Marx. And when I'm visiting the 21st century, I listen to Arts Express with host Prairie Miller. You have nothing to lose but your chains. You have a world to win. Listeners of the world, unite.
That's every Thursday at 2 p.m. Arts Express with host Prairie Miller, where art meets politics. And if you're down with the status quo, take the local.
Is the morning news bringing you down? Have you ever wished there was a news program focusing on the positive? Every Thursday morning from 6 to 8 a.m., WBAI has got you covered. Best of the Best is a show chronicling everything that's great in the world of politics, pop culture, and technology. Join host Kirsten Magwood, along with her cohorts Jason Bernard Lucas of the Brooklyn band Dragons of Zinth and the Somalian journalist and activist Rhoda Griffin, as they mix it up with experts, tastemakers, and snobs to figure out what's really good. That's Best of the Best every Thursday morning from 6 to 8 a.m. only on WBAI New York.
Arise, you workers, from your slumber, all you wage slaves, everyone.
The revolution comes like thunder.
Mayday, yes, this Mayday will build bridges to the millions across the globe as they resist Trumpian-style policies, where the rich get richer by exploiting and abusing we who do the work and create the wealth. Tuesday, May 1st, 3 to 7 p.m. Tune in and hear We the People in Motion on Mayday. Listen to the movers and shakers, the working masses putting the movement back into the labor movement. Mayday, Mayday, Tuesday, May 1st, 3 to 7 p.m. over WBAI, 99.5 FM. We're building bridges, produced by Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
The Internationale unites the human race.
Ah, New York City. Countless movies and TV shows have been shot here. And in all those movies, everyone's young and attractive. No one has a real job, but they all live in fabulous, giant apartments on Park Avenue. That is not New York, okay? New York is loud, it's expensive, it's dirty. New York is a crowded subway that never shows up on time. That's New York. And with 13 million people here every day, everyone's got a different story. So tune in here every Thursday from 7 to 8 to hear me, Marie Faustin, share some of my stories and chat it up with some of my favorite storytellers from right here in the melting pot. Careful, it's hot. Every week we'll be serving up stories that'll have you laughing or crying or immediately booking a flight to the city that never sleeps. Don't worry, we'll leave the light on for you.
And it's just like we've decided there'd be some words we won't say all the time. And I was just trying to find out which words they were. I wanted a list, because nobody gives you a list. And all I could think of was motherfucking. That was my original list. I knew it wasn't complete, but it was a starter set, you know?
George Carlin in the 1970s. Now those seven words and more can be heard at WBAI's monthly benefit comedy show, Too Raw for Radio. It's Monday night, May 7th at 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons at 388 Atlantic Avenue. A $13 admission includes a $3 credit for food and drink at the cafe. That's Too Raw for Radio comedy show Monday, May 7th, 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons. And you can find us on Facebook at Too Raw for Radio.
And here's the list of words your dad and I don't ever want to hear you say.
Hey, thanks, Ma. Boy, that's going to save me an ass-kicking or two. Ah! Oh.
Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, enchantment, and the imagination. And it would seem pouring rain on our rooftop. I hope you can hear it and enjoy it. My guest this morning, after what, 30 years or so of trying, Scott Edelman. Stay tuned. And good morning. So this is Hour of the Wolf. Hey, Max. We have no internet connection, so the Facebook goes out in here. The Wi-Fi.
I can try to reboot it.
If you could, yeah. Or I mean, why is it going?
It's been doing that the last day or two.
Yeah.
I hear the weather sometimes is a factor.
Not if you have a good modem. Or wireless, or whatever. Anyhow, I hope you all at home are enjoying this. I know I am. When did the and who ordered this weather? I didn't order this weather. I hope everybody can hear. I'm going to turn up my mic real loud. Okay. You know, they used to sell record albums called Environments. And they had ambient sounds, and you could pay for an hour of rain. They sold well.
Well, you have indicated that it has been 30 years of trying to get me on your program, and I am endeavoring to make sure it is indeed a trying evening.
Or
morning.
Yes,
or whatever
it
this is.
Yeah, well, we will... Okay, the internet keeps popping in and out. Yes, thank you. One of our viewers on Facebook said, stream or stream not, there is no try.
A little secret.
Yeah?
If our internet doesn't work, try the commons.
This attaches to whatever is strongest near it.
You can't change it?
Yes, I can, only by stopping the show and... you know...
I can tell you how to make it work.
And Carlining around for...
I'll tell you how to grouse.
Yes.
I'm telling you, connect to the cabinets.
Yeah, I've done that in the past. I probably already am. Somebody's saying, was that Max? No, that was Max. Wave at the camera, Max. No, other side. Near Scott.
We're not looking at you.
Down, sir. Down. No, we're not looking at me. Uh-huh. I have a guest. Max Scott. Scott Max.
How are you?
We've already spoken.
Oh, okay.
His T-shirt is drawn by Bob Eggleton, a friend of mine. A Facebook, the artist Bob Eggleton, famous Monsters Godzilla there.
Okay. So you see Max Scott here.
Yes.
Would know people like Scott Eggleton.
Bob Eggleton.
Bob, I'm sorry.
Hugo-winning artist.
Hugo-winning artist. But you know him where? From Marvel or from...
Well, he drew for me when I was editing Science Fiction Age ages ago.
Ah, okay. Which you did for about 7 years.
Just from being in science fiction fandom.
Yeah. So why don't you tell the listeners, who am you? Aside from being Scott Edelman,
I am Groot. You know
oh,
that.
Oh, God. God, I just watched a wonderful YouTube video earlier of the actor, I forget who it is, doing the voice linking of I am Groot in about 7 languages for all the different versions that were guarding the galaxy.
Well, do you know I actually had to be Groot a few years ago at the Nebula Award ceremony?
No, I did not.
Well, I was called upon to accept the Nebula Award when, I guess, Guardians of the Galaxy won the Nebula, the screenplay won for best screenplay, and they came to me and said, would you accept it, but we only want you when you come on stage saying, oh, the producers couldn't be here, there were a few words they wished you to say. And I go on stage, and I open the piece of paper, and I look at it, and all I said was, I am Groot.
Okay.
Several times, and then held the trophy aloft and walked. So I did actually get to be Groot on behalf of Guardians of the Galaxy folks.
Oh, that's
that is not the only thing. I go way, way back. I started working at Marvel Comics in 1974. I was on staff for several years, wrote Captain Marvel. Ton of other things.
You wrote her as a guy.
No, well, yes, that's true. That's true. Well,
yeah. So you weren't woke.
No one was woke back then.
No.
I don't think so.
No, I was on 5 to 7 a.m. You know, then, so I certainly wasn't woke.
You know, however, something I only learned a few months ago, I don't know how many comic book people there are in the audience, but a villain.
Oh, there are more than a few.
All right. Well, a villain I co-created with artist Alan Milgram in Captain Marvel number 50 will be appearing in the Captain Marvel movie March, which I discovered when all of a sudden, as you know, writers are very egotistical and we always have ourselves on alerts for Google whenever our names are mentioned. One morning I was getting all these alerts that my name was being mentioned. Well, it was because an actress, Gemma Files, was from the show Humans, had been cast as Dr. Minerva. And will be the villain against the current Captain Marvel, played by what, Brie Larson, is that?
Yes.
In the next movie.
I'm sorry, now how is Gemma involved?
She was cast as the villain that I created in Captain Marvel number 50.
I know Gemma.
She's the star of the Humans, one of the stars of the... Well, no, Gemma Chan, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Jeez.
Gemma Chan, yes.
Gemma Files is a science fiction writer.
That's what it would be very interesting if a
writer.
Science fiction writer had been cast. Well,
I mean, she's very photogenic.
Yes, yes, but no, Gemma Chan.
Excuse me.
But, you know, I did Marvel Comics for a while. I wrote for DC Comics as well. Wrote a couple of Supergirl adventures, wrote a lot of House of Mystery, House of Secrets stories, all those spooky things that weren't quite as spooky as EC Comics.
Right.
Moved on.
Did you ever write for EC?
No, I was not. I was just born at that time, I think.
Wow.
In the early 50s, they were not willing to hire me in the diaper, unfortunately.
Ah.
No.
Here they were for me. I pretty much started working
I did go. This
in
is
a diaper.
My fandom. I mean,
I was an adult. But
yes. No. Well, fandom is responsible for everything that's happened to me. I was at the EC Fan Attic Convention in 1972 when I met Bill Gaines and all the artists and writers at the time. But my first comic book convention was in 1970 when I was 15, and that was the beginning of everything, and I've been to thousands of conventions since then, as you probably have. So it started
less
from,
now than I used to. I mean, in about 1980, I figure, in 1980 I attended over 30 conventions in the 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And sometime after that, I started weaning myself, so now I do about 3 a year.
Yeah, I probably did it no more than 15, so you've got me beat with that. But fandom was where I began. Then I moved into comics. Then there was a time when I said I want to get out of comics because they say you should never see the sausage being made or be too involved in something you love.
Uh-huh.
And I went to the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop in 1979 saying, help, I want to not write comics anymore. I want to focus on science fiction and fantasy and horror and all that. And then I was just focusing on my own writing. Then I edited a series of magazines, starting with Last Wave in the 80s, and then Science Fiction Age from 1992 to 2000.
I have a number of issues of Science Fiction Age.
I was very pleased that we had someone win a Nebula Award the